We have, as most of you know, an annual cycle of these readings, 52 or 53 readings, this being the first one. It's a coincidence this year that the first reading is also Master's birthday, but a very nice coincidence. Many of you were here last night for the celebration of Yogananda's birthday. It's traditional in an ashram that you don't actually celebrate anybody's birthday except the guru's birthday. And remember the first January 5th with Swamiji when he would just greet us all, happy birthday! You would sort of pause for a moment and try to realize, but it's really the only significant birthday for all of us is the birthday that ends all birthdays, that stops the rebirthing of birthdays endlessly. So we celebrate Master's birthday, and we celebrate Swami's birthday, and we celebrate our own, but not with quite as much oomph as we would. The only thing to celebrate is divine realization, and that's what we want. In the reading today, which begins with the word, Swami uses the word vibration. And elsewhere when he's commenting at greater length about the word and what it means, and emphasizing that it's not merely sound, because word is something quite specific. Word conveys meaning. Word implies thought. Word implies something that leads to action, to decision-making. It's not just noise. So when we say in the beginning was the word, we're implying a lot of other intelligent, conscious, deliberate realities than just in the beginning was something, and then after that came something else. And the word vibration that Swami comments upon, which is often used in English because we don't really have precise words for these things, he said the difference between a vibration and a sound, among other things, is that a vibration emanates from some point. When something is vibrating, that means it has a fixed reality and it's moving away from that. Sometimes when Karen is leading the choir, she wears her little tuning fork. I mean, it's amusing to those of us who haven't seen it, but it's very common, I guess. She wears a little tuning fork and she'll whack it against her head and then listen in her ear, and the little forked thing like this will vibrate at whatever exact tone it is, and she can pick out whatever tone she needs from hearing the one set. But what the way the tuning fork works is when it's perfectly still, it makes no sound at all. It's just an inert object, like a fork, like your own fork that you're eating with. But if you strike it with something and it begins to move, then all of a sudden with that movement comes sound and a whole other lot of realities come. This idea of vibration as emanating from a fixed point, for me personally, has been one of the essential attracting forces that drew me onto the spiritual path. Because my life, and I'm using myself as an example in the thought that some of you may have experienced the same thing, I was looking for the unifying principle in life. Self-aggrandizement didn't seem to do it. Money didn't seem to do it. Fame, worldly success. I mean, all of these things I worked through in theory before I was 18 years old. It wasn't like I lived through all of them in this particular incarnation. But there was a certain transparent emptiness to those realities that caused me, I feel like I stood at the sidelines of life, really, and I really feel that way until I met Swami Kriyananda. Even though I did a few things, I just was waiting. I was waiting for somebody to give me a clue. And when I actually began to understand the principles of self-realization and understood that life is this journey and we're going somewhere. And even more importantly than just we're standing here and we're going there, because that implies a certain, well, you just have to put up with what's happening now because eventually it's going to be okay. Like one of my friends who was raised a Catholic was told by the nuns when he protested against having to be good, which he found quite confining and very unentertaining. The nuns promised him that if he was good, he would have a bigger house in heaven. And he was absolutely delighted to be told that because he didn't care how big his house was in heaven. And that basically gave him free rein to do anything he wanted to do. So far from succeeding with him, it was a total disaster. Well, in my own reality, I could sense, as all of us sense. We're born with this longing to be happy. It's just right there, isn't it? I was traveling once, one of the times when I was traveling, and we were in some airport in some foreign country, and you've been on who knows how many flights through how many time zones, and even as an adult person, you have no concept of where you are, whether it's day or night or breakfast or dinner. Someone said, when all the clothes we're wearing turn into laundry, we're there. That's how you could tell. But there was this little baby. He was maybe 2 years old, and the parents were pushing him in a stroller, and the parents looked utterly beleaguered, and the child was just miserable from all of this going. And he was just waving his arms and kicking his legs, and he didn't have language, so he was just making those kinds of noises. But his meaning was perfectly clear. I am uncomfortable. Somebody do something. And he just kept repeating it over and over, somebody do something. And there was very little that anybody could do because he was just too discombobulated and his parents were too discombobulated. And I just watched the poor little lad be so miserable. And I thought, well, honey, get used to it. This is going to go on for a really long time. You know you're going to arrive at your destination. But isn't that the reality that so many of us are in so much of the time in our lives? Somebody do something. You know, my heart is broken, my dreams are disappointed, the acts of fate are so bizarre, the strangeness of other people who share this planet with me, their behaviors are so unfathomable. I was talking to a friend of mine about a difficulty that she went through. She went through a 10-year ordeal of interpersonal conflict that finally was resolved in a glorious moment of grace. And it was such an important event. And she was talking to Swamiji about it some 5 years later, and he referred to it as, oh, yell that. Just like, oh, yell that. And it wasn't like he didn't know. At the time, he was very helpful to her. But I said, just think what it all looks like to him. You know, here he's offering us, here he lived with this great master, here he understands an infinity of bliss. And he watches us just like little mice gnawing at each other's ears, you know, trying to get somebody else's food, pushing someone else out of the nest. The movie, I can't remember, it was the movie Migration. It was the movie all about the birds that was such a beautiful movie. Some of you may remember, the thing I remember most about it, I believe it was the first scene. Apparently, you know, some birds are irresponsible parents and they lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, and then those birds just grow up and somebody else has to take care of them. It's a pretty good system if you can work it. So the first picture was blind, featherless, little, ugly little things in a nest there, and one of them was like four times as big as the others. And he was pushing all the little ones out of the nest. I mean, he was murdering them. There's no other word for it. Fratricide is what he was doing. Just this kind of blind, and he was just pushing them until they were falling out of the nest, and now he was going to be the only one left. And I thought, no wonder karma is so difficult to work out. Look how early it starts. You know? And by the time we're human beings and you have this irrational dislike of someone and he seems like such a threat to you, and way back there, your little individuality, he was a cuckoo egg and he was pushing you out of the nest. And the thoughts like that, movies like that, they can leave you really, really depressed. I mean, terribly depressed. I mean, even little blind fledglings are just murdering each other. We want to have such a beautiful view of nature. I'm always amused because if the movie is about the seals, you don't really feel very sorry for the fish that the seals eat. If the movie is about the fish, you feel really sorry for the fish who are being eaten by the seals, because it's all very impersonal. Everything is just moving in the way it's moving, and the devas in charge of the seals take care of them, and the devas in charge of the fish take care of the fish, and they all sort of, it all works together because you see it's all a vibration. I'm going to come all the way back to in the beginning was the word. It's all a vibration. It's all a movement from a specific point. And that point is our unity with the divine, our unity with bliss, our unity with our true nature. And even though we move very, very far away from it, we are not an object rolling endlessly. We are only a vibration. And no matter how far we're able to push that vibration because it's only a vibration. Sooner or later, it's going to have to come back. And when I first came onto the spiritual path, I didn't really have much of a comprehension of what it was I was getting into. But I had an intuitive recognition that I had discovered a fixed point of reality. And once there was one fixed point, absolutely everything could be deciphered from that. In my own personal experience, at first it was philosophical, and then it was personified by Swami Kriyananda, who himself personified that consciousness as he had received it from Yogananda. Last night, as part of our celebration of Master's birthday, we collected a number of videos. There's actually quite a lot of Yogananda. He died in 1952. There's quite a lot of film about him, but it's in the hands of this group of people who feel it's their responsibility to protect it from being viewed for reasons that are quite unknown. But it's beginning to leak out. People are taking, on the occasions when it's actually shown, people are taking little telephones in and filming the videos. You know, it's like technology is working against secrecy, which is one of the things that's happening now. So we collected a number of films that people really hadn't seen much before. And you're looking at these pictures of Yogananda, and you can go onto YouTube and start looking around, noodling around. Sometimes they get pulled off, but there's quite a few of them up there. Ananda itself, who has a completely different attitude, the films that we have are quite readily available if you look for them. So you have these pictures of Yogananda, and he was a man. He lived in a human body. His body was created by his mother and father. He came out of his mother's womb. We have not created a creation myth around him. He doesn't really want a creation myth. He talks about being a child in a Bengali home. He talks about being in the crib as a child and describing his child's consciousness as he describes a multitude of languages were going on at the same time, and gradually out of all that he began to recognize that Bengali was the language that was being consistently spoken where he was now. And he makes a comment about how little we understand the scope of a baby's brain, really, because once you think about reincarnation, you realize that a fully evolved being is simply functioning through an instrument that they have to train a little bit before they can begin to use it. But Yogananda, he lived in a human body, but the human body, human beings are considered to be the highest species, not merely out of human chauvinism because we wrote the books, but the masters tell us, because there is a fixed point of reference to this universe, the human nervous system has the capacity to perceive infinity. And it's sophisticated enough that we can live within a human body and yet our awareness can expand out to infinity. That's why so much of the human brain is not actually used, which befuddles medical people who don't think about this. They don't understand what the human body is really for. So once we get to the human body, we don't have to make a new kind of body. We just have to learn how to use it. Just like babies have to learn how to use it, just like everybody has to learn how to use their human body. And you see that people use their human bodies more or less well. Some of them use them just for sex and drinking. It's like they take the most obvious sort of stimulation possible in a human body and just go after it, just avidly, not much different than animals. And then we begin to educate ourselves, we begin to evolve a little bit, and even the degree to which we remain sexual beings, at least we refine it. It becomes monogamous. It becomes more sophisticated. It becomes less animalistic. You know, there's degrees of everything. We don't just turn our backs on things all at once. But someone like Yogananda, of which there aren't very many like, but a self-realized master or a great saint, and I put Swami Kriyananda in that category, they've really learned how to use the awareness potential of the human body. And so they move through the world just as Jesus moved through the world, walking around looking a lot like the rest of us, but the vibration of their consciousness is completely different. And in the films of Yogananda that some of you saw last night and others of you can see, It's so amazing, especially some parts of it, because every so often the camera comes in clear enough on the expression on his face or the look in his eyes, and you realize you've never seen it anywhere else, ever. It just comes into focus, and even though it's just the same human face, the vibration behind it is of infinity. I vividly recall the first time I met a person of elevated consciousness. It was before I met Swami Kriyananda. He was the second person I met. The first one I met was a Swami from India who was speaking at the Vedanta Society Ramakrishna Mission in Hollywood, California, where I lived at the time, and I used to go to that temple. And he came and spoke, and he was not, I don't know whether he was that adept in English. He was adequate in English. He was an educated Indian and therefore hadn't been educated in English, but the accent was a little unfamiliar. But he was not a linear thinker. And I was an exceedingly linear thinker at that time. And so he gave a discourse of the type that I'm giving right now, except it didn't really follow any particular line. He kind of went here for a while and then went there for a while and then it would go over here and then he would laugh about something and then he would do this over here. And so part of me was just trying to put him together like I would have done a college lecture. And simultaneously, to my complete inability to grasp his concepts, I was receiving his consciousness. And I was aware, for the first time in my life, that I was in the presence of something that I had never experienced before. And to this day, and that would have been, I was 19 years old, so we can guess how long ago that was, I remember looking at that man's eyes, looking at just normal human eyes, but they weren't. It's like the world he was living in was different. His vibration, he was so much closer to the source of everything that his whole vibration was different. And that's what I felt when Swami Kriyananda walked into the room. Swami Kriyananda walked into the room the first time, 1969 for me. And he walked into the room. He didn't speak. I knew nothing about him, really, except that my friend had invited me because she was impressed. And I said, he has what I want. That was just like, where did that come from? I didn't even know what to speak of recognizing him. I didn't even know what I wanted, but I knew that he had it. Because this world is a vibration. And we vibrate from our origin point of perfect bliss. We vibrate from that point of perfect satisfaction, from that intuitive knowing that we were destined for something that we don't quite yet have. But somehow or another, we can't give it up. We can't give it up because we're tethered to it. No matter how far away we move, no matter how evil or contrary we act in regard to that, we can never separate ourselves from it. This is where Swamiji added into the Festival of Light a few lines that we now say. You know, God loves us all equally, not just Jesus Christ and the great masters of all religions, but even those on earth who have sinned most greatly. In the eyes of God, we are all the same. That's just really hard sometimes to actually accept that, isn't it? In fact, a part of us wants to not accept it. We want to be angry. We want to be angry at the drunk driver who caused difficulty in our lives. We want to be angry at about the young boy whose life was cut off early because of the murderous rage of someone. We want to be angry about events in the newspaper, about unmitigated greed, about the stupidity of people who shouldn't be so, who have responsibility for others. We want to be angry about that. We want to say somebody is at fault. We want to make it not our responsibility to find our way back to our point of origin. And the only difficulty with doing that, it's really, there's only one problem. It doesn't work. That's all. If it worked, it would be great. It would be just fabulous if we could just make a list of grievances and blame them. You know, then we can just organize everybody to punish them, and then it'll all just be great, won't it? And we've tried, believe me. I was told once by a psychic, truth or otherwise, I don't know. She told me that I helped start the French Revolution, was actually how she put it. In other words, that this gift of gab that I have has not always been used for the highest purpose. you know, that I can be very, could be very persuasive toward whatever cause I believed in. I don't have the foggiest idea if it's true or not, but it could be true. I think the reason that God has me talking so much about truth as I know it now is because I talked a lot about stuff that wasn't quite so notable. When I had to go once, it was the collective decision of the people here. When we first got this building, somebody had to go down to the Palo Alto Planning Department and talk to them about the sign out front. And it's just somehow, either I volunteered or someone suggested I should go. Nobody was thinking clearly. So anyway, I went down there, and I'm talking to some woman, some bureaucrat, and she was so petty. She was so indifferent to my reality. She was so unconcerned about what I was trying to accomplish, and yet she had all the power. She had all the power to impose upon me her stupid, narrow-minded, don't let it get me started. I became enraged. It was really like, it was impressive, and it was a little scary. I just became absolutely enraged. I finally had the sense to not say anything, thank God. I walk out of there. But I mean, I was thinking about Molotov cocktails. I was thinking about blowing. I'm looking at that Palo Alto building, town hall, thinking about, you know, where the entrances would be and how we could dynamite the whole thing. And it was not casual. It was real thought. It was real karmic memory of been there, done that. Didn't really work. I mean, so I came home and I said, David, what were we thinking? Why did we send me there? Don't ever let me near those places again. Back in the 1970s at Ananda Village, when we were first working with the county, every so often we'd have county hearings, and I just had so little patience with all that system. I never really worked on a day-to-day basis, but every so often when there would be a hearing, and they would want a really strong statement. I used to joke about it. They would like put a towel over me and then they'd kind of roll me in and they'd hold me in the back. And then when they needed me, they'd turn me around, pull the towel off, and I would just blurt out something really fierce. Then they'd cover me up and take me off again. But it didn't work. You know, you're satisfied for a moment, you're angry for a moment, but innocent people are hurt. And in the end, it all just, the water closes over it and it's just the same. Because it's not our point of origin. Changing this world, making this world right is not our point of origin. We're vibrating from our relationship with God. And Master comes in. And Master knows more than any of us. Swamiji knows more than any of us. The frustrations we've been through, how tempted we are, how painful so many of our experiences are, how we agonize through these events for so long and are so proud of our little victories. And it's not that they're not utterly sympathetic, but they know who we are. They know where we're going. And the mere, just the look in Yogananda's eyes, just the pictures, I'm sure all of you have spent much time as I've spent time, just that's where we have the pictures on the altar, so that you can just look into those eyes. What does it feel like to really be standing at the origin point of all of this? And that's how we gradually, the spiritual life becomes really remarkably simple for something that's so complicated. We're just always looking to where am I vibrating? What is my vibration? And how far away have I moved from my point of origin? And that point of origin is not passive or doormat-like, necessarily. Yogananda was Arjuna, who was a warrior in his past life. Krishna urged him to fight a battle. He said he was William the Conqueror. He was a great soldier many times. But how we act is not the same as what our consciousness is. And where is our consciousness? Where is our vibration? How far have we moved away from our point of origin? If I'm upset, angry, restless, lack of faith, if I don't understand, if I think it's someone else's fault, oh, okay, here I am. Now I just have to roll it back to the point of origin. When I discovered the path of self-realization those many years ago, and I realized that there was a fixed point of reality in the universe, and that was the point of bliss. absolutely everything in an instant just completely turned over. Because then no matter what happens, no matter what happens, there's a constant thread to always come back. And we have tough karma sometimes. People have very tough karma. I remember this friend of mine. He divorced and his child grew up to be 18 years old. He steadfastly and religiously paid his child support payments the entire time. After his son was 18, his ex-wife falsified legal documents, claimed he'd never paid any money at all, forged his signature, said he'd been served the papers, got a judgment against him. He lost his driver's license. He lost his passport. He also got terminal cancer. And then I was trying to help him, and I called a defense attorney of mine, a friend of mine, who defends guilty criminals mostly. And he said, well, have him come in and have him bring his bank records. I said, oh, I forgot to say his house burned down, so he has no records. The attorney's response, I've never forgotten it. Yes, yes, it would, he said like that. Yes, of course, his house would also burn down. Meaning once you sort of get into these karmic cycles, they just keep going. You just get into a vibration like that, it goes a certain distance, and then at a certain time, karma ends and it always comes back. That's the most amazing factor to think about karma. You see, because it's from a fixed point, it's only a vibration. No matter how far it goes in any direction, it absolutely has to come back to its point of origin. This is the happy ending. This is why every story, no matter how grim it becomes, and it's a hard teaching to accept, that no matter how far we're pushing it this way, it's because it's the mirror image of the opposite. And that eventually it comes back to center. This is what meditation is. This is what Kriya Yoga is. This is what discipleship is. This is what Guru Bhakti is. Devotion to the Guru is just saying, I don't want to be out there in all those vibrations anymore. I just want to be standing where you are standing. And over again, the word, the pure vibration of spirit is made manifest. Whether it's Jesus, Yogananda, Buddha, masters yet unknown to us, they manifest and vibrate. Well, I would say they don't vibrate, but they vibrate with perfect stillness. And we find that point in the universe. And it becomes literally our pole star. I have made thee pole star of my life. Though my seas are dark and my stars are gone, still I see thy light through thy mercy. What promise, what power, what ultimate freedom and bliss. God bless you.